Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. As the 2025 session of the Utah Legislature enters its second week, there are many organizations advocating for their causes. Today we'll talk with several of these groups, including the Utah Taxpayers Association, Friends of the Great Salt Lake, the Sutherland Institute, Heal Utah, the Libertas Institute, and the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance. We'd also love to hear what you think the legislature should do this session. You can help guide our planning of issues to cover on Access Utah during the session as well with your email right now to upraccess@gmail.com, upraccess@gmail.com. We hope you join us following the news. Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. As the 2025 session of the Utah Legislature enters its second week, there are many organizations advocating for their causes. Today we'll talk with several of these groups, including the Utah Taxpayers Association, Friends of the Great Salt Lake, the Sutherland Institute, Heal Utah, and the Libertas Institute. We'd also love to hear what you think the legislature should do this session. You can help guide our planning of issues to cover on Access Utah during the session with your email right now to upraccess@gmail.com, upraccess@gmail.com. And we begin with the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance. We bring in Grant Stevens, Communications Director for the Alliance. Grant Stevens, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having us on today, Tom.
So with Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance, we'll be talking more about what you hope Congress will do, I guess, because you're dealing with issues regarding federal lands. Let me ask a couple questions, then I'll ask an open-ended question. I want to start with Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument, Bears Ears National Monument. What is SUA? Are you expecting, like the rest of us, President Trump is likely to reduce those monuments the way he did in his first term?
We're anticipating that that's likely. We're certainly hoping that he's not going to be doing that. We know that national monuments, and in particular Grand Staircase Escalante and Bears Ears, are incredibly popular with Utahns and with Americans nationwide. So we're really hoping that President Trump doesn't reduce the monuments as he tried to do in 2017, but we're certainly going to be closely watching that.
The Antiquities Act's been hotly debated in recent years, of course, you know, in part because these monuments have been ping-ponging back and forth between established, expanded, reduced. What do you think on the latest attempt to strike or dismantle the Antiquities Act?
Sure. And are you talking about the bill that was introduced by Representative Malloy?
Representative Malloy, yes. Yes.
Yeah. I mean, we're incredibly disappointed with that. Like I was saying, national monuments really enjoy bipartisan support. They're overwhelmingly popular. We're certainly going to be pushing back on that. We'll be rallying our supporters both here in Utah and from across the country to ensure that bill does not go anywhere and that our national monuments stay protected and that the Antiquities Act stays in place as federal law as well.
Well, maybe articulate the need for that. Why does the president need that power?
Sure. Well, the Antiquities Act was passed in 1906. It's this incredibly long-standing law that has been used by presidents of both parties to protect archaeological and cultural sites and to protect wild places. So we see this happen all throughout the country. Four of our five national parks here in Utah started as national monuments, and they were eventually designated as national parks. And I think something that has always stuck out to me is that those are national monument designations in the long term are always viewed positively. They are always seen as, oh, we should have protected more of these places. We should have protected more cultural sites. We should have protected more intact landscapes instead of less. And so we want to ensure that the president continues to have the authority to do that, especially when Congress is slow to act and slow to protect these incredibly significant public lands.
Of course, the Trump administration, President Trump, spilling out his cabinet. He's nominated former North Dakota Governor Doug Burgum as Interior Secretary. What's your position on that?
Sure. We're opposed to Senator Burgum's nomination. We watched the Senate Energy and Natural Resources confirmation hearing along with a lot of other folks. I think that Governor Burgum has a lot of concerning views on opening up federal public lands for more oil and gas development, for more mining, for more kind of short-term extractive uses. So we're certainly opposed to Senator Burgum's nomination.
Of course, your organization opposes Utah's recent lawsuit, which was the Supreme Court refused to hear that. One of the points the state is putting forward is there's so much public land, federally controlled public land, in Utah, and that should be controlled by the state. What would be the harm there? What's the danger there if that were controlled by the state?
Sure. Well, federal public lands are owned and managed for all Americans. So here in Utah, we're fortunate enough to live very close to those. We obviously have many folks who make a living off of our federal public lands here. But federal public lands, like I said, managed for all Americans, they're also held to a higher standard at the federal government. The environmental protections are greater. There's much more of a long-term view. Our concern, especially if the state's lawsuit had moved forward, if they were successful on that, was that it called for the disposal and the sell-off of public lands, that these incredible places would be privatized, that they would be developed, and that they may end up being turned over to the state in some way, but that is also certainly not a guarantee.
So I'll go open-ended now. What are some other issues that Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance is keeping their eyes on?
Sure. You mentioned kind of we're primarily focused on federal public lands issues. We have our signature legislation, America's Red Rock Wilderness Act. So this would protect 8 million acres of public land in southern Utah as wilderness, which is the highest level of protection that's available. We're in the process right now of getting co-sponsors for that legislation. So we're working with our supporters all throughout the country to get new representatives, new senators supportive of America's Red Rock Wilderness Act. And so we're in the process of doing that right now.
Is there any legislation you're hoping to get through Congress this year?
There's not, I guess, one specific one that comes to mind. I would say there'll be a lot of kind of opportunities for new land and water protections is our hope. We'll certainly be playing defense as well, but our hope would certainly be that there's new land and water protections here in Utah, whether that's wilderness or other designations.
You mentioned playing defense. How do you do that? And what would you counsel folks to do? You know, regular folks to do to influence legislation.
Sure. I mean, I'd encourage you, so on our website, SUA.org, we've got kind of all sorts of resources and information about how to speak up, how to use your voice on those things, whether that's reaching out to our governor and our lieutenant governor, or whether that's reaching out to our federal delegation. SUA is also really fortunate. We work in partnership with a lot of other nonprofit organizations here in Utah, but also nationally. So again, I think it's always kind of speaking with a big voice in a coalition with other folks as well.
Well, Grant Stevens is Communications Director for Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance. Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Tom.
Thank you. You are listening to Access Utah, and we're looking at the 2025 session of the Utah Legislature. It's in full swing now, second week. And we're talking with several groups who are advocating for their issues in front of the legislature. Later in the program, we'll be talking with representatives from Utah Taxpayers Association, Friends of Great Salt Lake, Heal Utah, and Libertas Institute. Right now, we're bringing in Nick Dunn, who's Vice President for Communications and Strategy with the Sutherland Institute. Nick Dunn, thanks for joining us.
Good Good morning. Good to be with you guys.
Good morning. For those who don't know, tell us just a bit about Sutherland Institute. What kinds of issues are you guys interested in?
Sure. So Sutherland Institute is a Utah-based nonprofit public policy organization. And really, the reason we exist is to equip Americans to advance principled public policy, but do so in a way that the policy and the advancement of those ideas promotes what we would describe as the constitutional values of faith, family, and freedom. So those are kind of our three anchoring pillars, anchoring principles for our organization. And we do that through policy research, through events, through engaging and informing elected officials and voters alike. We also have a robust multimedia arm with a weekly podcast called Defending Ideas, and essentially try to elevate the conversation around key policy challenges that the state and nation faces, but do so in such a way that we're bringing to bear America's founding ideals, our aspirational principles as a nation, and applying those to the challenges of the day. And a good, I think, way to think about it for your listeners is that there are, of course, many policy organizations out there in the state and across the nation, that many of which do very impactful work. There are some who do kind of focus on this principled lens, looking at the American founding and those principles and how they are still important today. There are organizations that look at data and evidence in very thorough and thoughtful research and bring those things to the table. And there are organizations that look to inform and at times advocate on issues and legislation. What I think is the unique value add of Sutherland Institute is that Sutherland Institute does all three of those things together. It's a fairly unique organization that is able to bring that principled lens focused on the aspirational ideals of the American founding, coupled with very thoughtful research and evidence and data, bringing those to the table for the purpose of informing and at times advocating on issues facing our state and our nation. So that's a good way for your audience to conceptualize what Sutherland Institute does here in Utah.
What does Sutherland have its eye on in terms of legislation and issues at the current session of the legislature?
Sure. So as I mentioned, with kind of our three pillars of faith, family, and freedom, within that realm is some focus on the presence and the importance of faith in our society. And so looking at some opportunities to commemorate through a resolution, again, the role and the positive impact of faith and religious freedom in our community. We also are closely watching education issues. In particular, our education policy fellow, Christine Fairbanks, has done a lot of work on this principle of sort of a parent-teacher partnership, that we really want to frame the education policy debate around this idea that parents and teachers are engaged in a partnership together. And when kids go into public schools, that partnership is what helps to lead to good educational outcomes. So part of that involves things we're looking at, such as having, you know, parents and teachers work together on curriculum materials, on information sharing, and so looking at some ways to incentivize or reward or recognize when those communication channels are strong and robust between teachers and parents, because that's a really vital part of public education. So those are a couple of them. A couple additional things that I'll mention. We, of course, are watching election policy very closely. That has been an area of a lot of discussion in recent months and years. And one of the things that Sutherland Institute has been doing on the front of election and voting policy is, again, bringing sort of some core principles to the table. And the simplest way to describe it is that it should be easy to vote and hard to cheat. We didn't coin that phrase. I think that phrase has been around for a number of years and been used in different parts of the country. But that's a good anchoring principle. And then looking at when we're talking about particular reforms to Utah's election and voting policy, we should be asking the question, is this a reform that will either fundamentally and tangibly improve and strengthen the integrity of our elections, as well as will this increase or improve public trust in elections? And we've actually put out some research to that latter question, essentially asking Utahns from, you know, various different reforms, what kinds of reforms would help to strengthen your trust in the integrity of Utah's election system, and what kinds of reforms may not have that impact. So that of course, will be a robust issue this session. The last one I'll mention, and this is obviously a quick flyby, there are a number of important issues this session and a number of areas that Sutherland is involved in. But the last one I'll mention is looking at how to strengthen opportunity and upward mobility for Utahns who might feel stuck in poverty. And this one is important because Utah already ranks so highly when it comes to upward mobility. In fact, we are the top-ranked state in the nation for upward mobility. We have one of, if not the best, economies in the nation. There is a tremendous amount of economic opportunity and upward mobility here in the state. Even so, we recognize that there are still families who are stuck in what we would call a cycle of intergenerational poverty. The state has done tremendous work on that over the years. So what we're looking at specifically is a pilot program to help families who are currently on the public assistance safety net, so receiving government benefits, looking at ways to help them more effectively and more easily navigate how to transition off of those benefits as they pursue work opportunities with the goal of work-based self-reliance. So we want to strengthen the ability for these families who want to be self-reliant to address what at times for them feels like disincentives, that if they earn more, then they actually get penalized and end up financially worse off or no better off because of the way the public benefits programs can sometimes work. That perception, that experience, and those potential disincentives are the big focus of sort of the welfare reform effort, again, to strengthen the American dream really for these families. So that's a good overview of some of the key issues we're looking at this session.
All right. Well, thank you so much. Nick Dunn, Vice President for Communications and Strategy for the Sutherland Institute. Thank you so much for telling us about it.
Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you. You're listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking with Linda Freitas, Executive Director of Friends of the Great Salt Lake. Later in the program, we'll be hearing from Heal Utah, Utah Taxpayers Association, and Libertas Institute as we talk with groups who are advocating for their issues in front of the Utah legislature. Their 2025 session's now in their second week. We'll have more following this break. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're in the second week now of the 2025 Utah legislature. Many organizations trying to get their issues in front of the legislature, get some legislation passed. We turn next to Linda Freitas, Executive Director of Friends of Great Salt Lake. Lynn, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for the opportunity, Tom.
So the Great Salt Lake did get quite a bit of attention in the last couple of sessions of the legislature. And some things passed. I'm sure you're thinking that a lot more needs to be done. What specifically are you hoping gets passed this session?
Well, I think the general disposition of what's going on during this legislative session is the fact that prior legislation that has been really significant with funding support and awareness building and commitments on behalf of conservation, monitoring, and dedication of inflows to Great Salt Lake. This session, as I'm seeing it, is more or less dotting the I's and crossing the T's of those touchstones of legislative awareness and support and laws, just to make sure that, the opportunities are refined and the effectiveness of those opportunities can be translated, in a timely and it's not chock full of money and additional funding, but there are ongoing programs that have been funded that are significant and are part of, this commitment, if you will, on behalf of Great Salt Lake's future and the sustainability of that ecologically and economically significant ecosystem to the people of Utah and global migratory bird population.
Are there any pieces of legislation you'd like to highlight?
Well, HB 244, Wildlife Management Area Amendment, sponsored by Representative Casey Snyder. This is an opportunity to consider Bear River Bay, which is an open water wildlife habitat that, you know, having a designation of a wildlife management area in Bear River Bay, basically to confirm that this particular part of the lake is significant, has tremendous value, would welcome additional opportunities for effective management, and a way in which a confirmation of this touchstone of Great Salt Lake wildlife habitat is you know, is recognized and elevated. So we're studying this bill, and, you know, we certainly appreciate Representative Snyder's initiative in this direction. And so it's something that we're keeping an eye on right now.
I notice on your website, again, we're talking with Linda Freitas from Friends of Great Salt Lake, there's a residential turf amendment, Representative Owens. You can talk about that specific bill, but how much of this helping the lake, saving the lake, how much of that is conservation with you and I? How much is industry? How much is agriculture? I guess it's everything together, I suppose.
It is. And, you know, we're very grateful for Representative Owens' initiative with there are three bills, actually, that he is sponsoring. And all of them focus on, you know, improved conservation ways of, you know, saving water, being more mindful of a limited resource. And they actually are, you know, supporting what came out of the Great Salt Lake Commissioner's 2024 strategic plan that basically says that 60% of Utah's residential water use goes toward outdoor irrigation. So ways in which we can become more efficient, we can, you know, help develop a behavior of our growing population in the recognition of what we can do on an individual basis on our properties and the way that we use, you know, sprinklers and watering systems to basically take care of that landscape, I think is definitely the step forward that we all need to be making. And I really appreciate Representative Owens' initiative with these bills.
I was recently reading the news. I'm sure you're very familiar with this. We had two incredibly wet years recently. This year doesn't seem to be as wet. And even with all that water, we seem to be back to 2021 levels with the lake. I wonder, overall, are you hopeful?
So thanks to the two good water years, we did improve our reservoir storage, mostly in the northern part of the state, but also the soil moisture as a result of those two great water years has improved as well. And so, you know, I mean, a part of the ebb and flow, if you will, of the effects of climate change and these variabilities that we're experiencing with weather trends certainly gives us an opportunity to, you know, think more carefully about laws and tools that are already in place. And again, how we can improve the efficiency of the way we regard a limited resource. I think in terms of the ongoing work of the Great Salt Lake Basin Integrated Plan, which came out of legislation a couple of years ago, and basically, you know, it was funded through the Bureau of Reclamation, through a Water Smart grant, and the Division of Water Resources, thanks to legislative funding support. But this plan basically is to, you know, kind of bring in a watershed-wide conversation, address gap analyses as we think about the fact that, you know, our population is going to double along the Wasatch Front primarily. We have a limited water resource. Great Salt Lake is now a part of its watershed. in this basin integrated plan. And with all of the recognition that that particular system is entitled to as we continue to confront climate change and population growth, the basin integrated plan will culminate in a final plan that, again, reflects a watershed participation process that will be, you know, a guide to help us ensure sufficient water for the watershed and Great Salt Lake as we continue to grow. So it's, you know, yes, it's like, you know, the snow year is kind of touch and go. But I think as far as our water year right now, we're about 80 some odd percent, there. But, you know, I think we're expecting some higher temperatures next week. So it's an ongoing process, but we can't take our eye off the ball with the fact that, again, we are part of, you know, the future. We have a responsibility to sustain our resources, our watershed, and Great Salt Lake as a part of that commitment.
Well, we've been talking with Linda Freitas, Executive Director of Friends of Great Salt Lake. Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Oh, my appreciation. Thanks, Tom. Take care.
Thank you. If you just joined us, you're listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking with various groups who are advocating issues in front of the Utah legislature, 2025 sessions in its second week now. And we turn next to Kaylee Kina with Heal Utah. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. What's your position there with Heal Utah?
I am the Community Engagement and Outreach Manager.
Okay, great. So tell us, remind us briefly what Heal Utah is and does.
Well, so Heal Utah, we are a 501c3 nonprofit, and our focus is within environmental policy and justice. And our goals are to protect communities from air pollution, to build an inclusive clean energy future, and to protect communities from radioactive and toxic exposure.
All right. And I'm sure you're keeping an eye on some bills at the legislature, some issues there. What tell us about some of those.
So at the top of the session, there were already over 400 bills released for the 2025 session so far. So we're, assuming that it will continue to be a bill-intensive session. Even though it's still early, there's already a lot of things moving through the floor. Something that Heal Utah does is we train regular community folks to go up and lobby and contact their legislators face-to-face or virtual, just to give us some support and apply some pressure to some areas that we think could really help improve our air quality or, at the very least, improve mitigations for the way we navigate with really bad air.
What would you like to see done? What needs to be done in terms of legislation regarding air quality?
Oh, that's a loaded question, but just some specific bills that we're watching that are a little bit easier to chew for most people. I feel like air quality can feel pretty abstract for most people since it's so big. But some of those smaller bills, or not smaller, some of those bills we're looking at is SB 103. That's a fireworks revisions, and Senator Plum is the bill sponsor for that. And this prohibits the sale of fireworks in restricted discharge areas if a municipality's fire chief and legislative body recommend the action. This is a good bill that can have a positive impact on our air quality. But there's also bills like HB 185, Railroad Modifications, which is sponsored by Representative Tyler Clancy. And this requires DAQ to conduct an emissions inventory for rail yards in ozone non-attainment counties and to develop a reduction plan. This is also a great bill. We've also noticed that energy is a top priority for Governor Cox and the legislature. So we expect the legislature to exert a lot of time and energy and money setting the stage for substantial nuclear energy development in the state of Utah. But under as far as mining and extraction goes, we're going to continue to see more regulations and support more oversight instead of decreasing regulation and oversight. We want to make sure that while we're building an inclusive future, that we are protecting all communities that are involved, because we do all breathe this air.
The governor and President Adams of the Senate have both said that the energy is top of their list, and they're both touting nuclear energy. What's Utah's position on that?
Well, our stance is always going to be, yes, we want a future in renewable energy. We also want to make sure that we're not taking advantage of the communities that are around and near some of these mining mills. So, for example, let me grab some notes here. We want to make sure that we're keeping an eye on bills such as HB 157, Energy Education Amendments. And so we're watching this because the task force is industry heavy and should be expanded to include local environment, nonprofits, and tribal communities. So we want to make sure that there are options for public comment from these communities. Sometimes they get left on the back burner or left to the very end of development. But we also want to get elected officials to make an amendment to add in environmental nonprofits and tribal communities as part of the task force. Again, just increasing the reach and public comment to make sure that people's concerns are included in development.
Just a couple minutes left in this segment. Anything else that you're especially keeping your eye on?
Well, as we don't specifically cover water, but water also has a lot to do with the air quality. So we also encourage people to stay updated with organizations such as Friends of Great Salt Lake. But we're also looking at some specific water policy amendments, specifically HB 41. So I don't know if you guys have previously talked about this or maybe I jumped in late, but water consumption is a significant concern in a desert state with a rapidly growing population. And so this bill includes several commendable provisions disregarding values that are deeply held by local residents, such as social, economic, public interest, and environmental considerations. So this could send a message that these priorities are not taken seriously. So far we support this bill with amendments to not remove language that focuses on balancing economic, social, and environmental needs. I know that's a lot of information, but the most important takeaway is that we want to make sure that our community is informed and that we can share resources and knowledge as often as we can. So we also encourage people to participate in our community lobbying program. We're up at the Hill every Tuesday. You can find us virtually through our event pages on our website as well on Tuesdays and Thursdays virtually.
I was going to ask you about that. Community lobbyists. Tell me just a little bit more about that.
Well, so just for clarification, instead of asking people to lobby with and on behalf of Hill, what we do is provide resources and training for people to go up and make contact with their legislators in their own time or with support from our staff. We want to make sure that people can gain that skill of talking to legislators. It can be a little bit intimidating. Oh, sorry if you hear my dog mom issues. But that can be a little intimidating, but it can also not be the easiest place to get up to physically. So that's why we offer virtual training as well, because being able to leave public comment to multiple legislators at one time is a great skill to take advantage of.
All right. Sounds good. We've been talking this part of the program with Kaylee Aquina, Community and Engagement Manager with Heal Utah. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you. We are talking with various groups advocating a wide variety of issues at the Utah Legislature this 2025 session. Following a break, we're going to be talking with Jason Chipman with Libertas Institute. We'll have more following this break. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking with various groups who are advocating for their issues in front of the Utah Legislature. We're in the second week of the 2025 Legislature now. And we are going to go next to an interview I recorded a week or so ago with Jason Chipman with Libertas Institute. The same subject matter here. What is Libertas looking at with the legislature? Let's hear this next. First of all, here, tell us your title there.
Director of Government Affairs.
This is the Libertas Institute. So this is Jason Chipman. So we're just asking various groups what you're looking to in the 2025 session of the Utah legislature. Are there any specific bills, or what are your top priorities?
For this year, one of our top priorities is housing reform. We've been in discussions with the Commission on Housing Affordability throughout the summer and fall, and one of our positions is some zoning reform within that. Our research came up with pretty much the same conclusion that Envision Utah, Utah Foundation, Ken Gardner, Sutherland Institute all came up with, was that zoning reform, while not a silver bullet, was probably the biggest impediment to increasing the stock of affordable housing, especially with starter homes.
So what would you like to have done in the legislature?
So what we'd like to have done is essentially allow for small lots. Eighth of an acre lots would be preferable. But even anything less than a quarter of an acre lot would be good, because cities have basically said, unless you have a quarter acre, half acre, something like that, you can't build a house. And that means with the price of land being what it is and being the primary driver of the higher cost of building a house, that just means that you're going to so many people are going to be priced out of the market. And so the average price of a house right now in Utah is $540,000, and when you're stuck putting that on a quarter acre lot, that's almost half the cost right there.
Do you have legislators you're working with? Any specific legislation?
So we're waiting for the omnibus consensus housing bill to come out from the Commission on Housing Affordability that usually is run by Senator Fillmore or Representative White, who both sit on the commission. And we've talked to many of those on the commission, as well as Senator Fillmore and Representative White, about our position. We've also spoken with the governor's housing czar many times and expressed to him, you know, what our thoughts on it are. And so we're just kind of waiting to see that come out and see what you are hoping to see is in the bill.
So housing, number one. Anything else that you're hoping to accomplish?
So a couple other things along the higher ed front. I know higher ed is kind of a hot button thing with the legislature right now. One of the things that we would like to see is some reform in the way that occupational licenses are issued. Right now, for a lot of occupational licenses, you have to have a degree from an accredited university as well as take a competency test. And what we'd like to do is remove the accreditation portion of that. And so for those occupational licenses that require a test, you could still take the test if you have a degree from an unaccredited university, and you can still get the license, but you wouldn't have to have it from an accredited university. Because if you can pass the test, you should be able to do the job. There's no guarantee that, a D student from an accredited university is going to be any better or worse than somebody from an unaccredited university. And that is something that DOPL already, the Department of Professional Licensure, already has the ability to do by rule, but they would like to see it done through statute. And so we're working with Representative Grecius. I'm not sure if that bill has been made public yet, but we're working to get that put into statute.
Anything else you'd like to mention?
We're always playing around in the tech space with AI. I know that is also a hot button issue, and so we've worked with the Abundance Institute recently and Representative Moss, the majority leader in the House, to address some of those issues to make it more of a partnership. We're also looking at some privacy issues, some background checks, allowing people to have more access to housing and employment when they have things on their background checks that are not convictions that keep them from getting a job or keep them from getting a house to be able to rent, when it's just, it could have been an arrest from years and years ago that's still on there for some reason. It's not an active investigation. That shouldn't count against them because they weren't convicted of anything. We would also like to see some movement in some business permitting reform. And we're working with Senator Musselman on a bill that would basically put a shot clock on cities for issuing business permits, business licenses to novel businesses. And it wouldn't say that the business had to be approved. It would still allow the city or the county to disapprove the application, but it would put some certainty on it, give a timeline for how long they could take. Now, I know some cities are going to argue that they don't have the resources to do this, but there are many small towns around Utah that actually have really good ordinances around this, and they have a shot clock for themselves saying, we only have so long to adjudicate it. Like I said, it doesn't say they have to approve it. They can deny it if they want to, but for somebody who's trying to start a business, they've got capital tied up in leases, equipment, all of the other various things that insurance they're going to need to have in line, and they cannot wait forever for a city to decide whether or not they can ply their trade or not. Those are kind of the big things that we're doing this year.
All right. Well, thank you so much for telling us about this. It's nice to get an overview. Jason Chipman, Director of Government Affairs for Libertas Institute. Appreciate it. Thanks.
Thank you.
You're listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams, and we're talking with various groups as the 2025 Utah legislature is in its second week now. I will conclude the program with a conversation with the Utah Taxpayers Association. We're talking to various groups, seeing what they're looking forward to in the upcoming session of the 2025 Utah legislature. And we're talking right now with Billy Hesterman, president of the Utah Taxpayers Association. Mr. Hesterman, thank you so much.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So what's on the watch list for the Utah Taxpayers Association? What are there potential bills or some things that you want to get accomplished?
Well, we already know that we're likely looking for a tax cut this year, which is always good news for taxpayers. In December, the Executive Appropriations Committee of the legislature, which is essentially the head budget committee, set aside $165 million to do a tax cut. So we're now waiting to see what that means, whether it means it could be a income tax rate reduction for everyone in the state, or they may follow through with the governor's proposal of eliminating the tax on Social Security for seniors, or maybe a mix of both. It might be a little, kind of a piecemeal some things together and see what they can do at the end. But that's the main thing we're watching right now is to see what they do with that money they set aside to give some relief to everyone in the state.
How are things looking with, with revenue, tax revenue? Is it looking like there is money that could be used for tax cut?
That's what our fingers are crossed for. We know that they have, again, set aside that money that they've already collected, but we do know that revenue in the state is looking a little flat at the moment, and so we're hoping that everyone, it did some good Christmas shopping, maybe did an addition or a remodel or something on their home as well, doing some things to increase the revenue for the state from the tax side so that there is money for the legislature to, follow through with the tax promises they made and also be able to, make sure that the government keeps providing the services that we all enjoy in the state. So a little bit down, we know they've directed their budget committees to not look to spend money this year, but look to save money. But hopefully that still includes a tax cut for everyone.
Tell me a little bit more about Governor Cox's proposal to remove the state tax on Social Security payments.
Sure. The last few years, the legislature has made the decision to increase the amount of exemption that we give to Social Security for income. So we are now at a point where if you have $75,000 in income and you receive Social Security, that Social Security would fall under that first $75,000. And Governor Cox has proposed that we fully eliminate the exemption all the way and make it so that no Social Security in the state is taxed. So any of our seniors that are receiving that would receive a great benefit. They estimate at the State Tax Commission that could be nearly $1,000 a year for a household that receives Social Security. And so that would be a significant tax break for our seniors in the state and probably really some needed relief for a lot of families.
You mentioned several possibilities in terms of tax cuts. Does the Taxpayers Association favor anyone over the other, or do you just want some tax cuts?
Well, if you're talking about what is the true, pure, fair tax reduction to do, it would be to just simply lower the income tax rate overall so that everyone in the state has a benefit. We're currently sitting at 4.55%. You could tick it down to 4.45 with that money that they've set aside for a tax cut, and that would be the true form of, broaden the base and lower the rate. When you take out the tax on Social Security, that is actually shrinking your base a little bit, but does provide an important tax relief to those who maybe are on a fixed income or those who don't have the ability to work as much as others. And so it's we'd welcome either, and both are good proposals. And, we'll see what they can put together by the end of the session. My guess is we'll see some kind of a combo of a little bit of an income tax rate drop and then maybe increasing that exemption for Social Security from $75,000 to $100,000.
So switching gears, playing defense, you might call it. Anything on the horizon that Utah Taxpayers Association wants to head off?
Well, there's always new ideas on how to collect revenue for government. Usually not at the state level, but we hear from our local levels, from the school districts, the counties, the cities, that they always want to find new ways to add additional money to their coffers as well. So there are some proposals that allowing for annual inflationary adjustments to everyone's property taxes instead of having to go through truth in taxation, which is the meeting notice that comes whenever a city or county or school district wants to raise your taxes. So some things like that we want to be careful to analyze and be cautious about. We know that there's some entities looking for the ability to increase their salary for part-time staff and those things, and we want to make sure that that's fair, but done in a way that's prudent to the taxpayer and efficient for them.
Anything else you'd like to say about the upcoming legislative session?
I think the key is involvement. Anyone who wants to be involved should be involved. You shouldn't be afraid of coming up to the state capitol or even just participating online. The legislature has done a great job to allow those who can't come to the Capitol still participate in the meetings. You can watch them online on their website. You can also make public comment through the website during the meetings. And really, those voices are heard. They're not just dismissed. So make sure that if you're interested and you care, you get involved. And really also reach out to your local legislators and talk to them and get to know them and share your insight with them. That's how, real things get done in our state, or those who show up make things happen. So take the opportunity to show up.
We've been talking with Billy Hesterman, president of the Utah Taxpayers Association. Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Hey, thank you.
It's the Beehive Archive on Utah Public Radio. I'm Megan Weiss. Museums are usually established in the public trust and in the public interest. But one museum in Salt Lake City's Marmalade District caused a whole whirlwind of drama, and even a state Supreme Court case. Find out more after this.
I'm Jody Graham, Director of Utah Humanities. Beehive Archive is brought to you on Utah Public Radio by Utah Humanities, with the generous support of the Lawrence T. and Janet T. D. Foundation. We are proud to partner with community organizations to tell Utah stories and hope you will tune in each week for the Beehive Archive.
Welcome to the Beehive Archive, a two-minute look at some of the most pivotal and peculiar events in Utah's history. Located at the top of Salt Lake City's Main Street, just west of Utah State Capitol Building, the Pioneer Memorial Museum houses everything from Brigham Young's wagon to a two-headed lamb. Now an important place preserving the history of Utah's first white settlers, the museum was once the subject of a lawsuit about who decides where museums should go and why. The Daughters of Utah Pioneers, or DUP for short, is a female-run nonprofit dedicated to preserving the heritage of people who settled the place we now call Utah between 1847 and 1869. They record family lore, preserve artifacts, and gather in camps to exchange histories about their ancestors. In the late 1930s, the DUP began advocating for their own museum to share their collection and host events. Breaking the strict gender norms of the period, DUP women directly lobbied lawmakers to fund their museum, filling the male-dominated legislature gallery to make their presence known. At the same time, they blended their lobbying with ideas about feminine hospitality, serving sandwiches, olives, drinks, and cookies to representatives in their office while discussing state building appropriations. Achieving funding for the building in 1945 solved only one problem for the DUP. The cost of materials nearly doubled after the war, making fundraising more difficult. Worse, neighbors in the Marmalade District where the building was planned protested the museum, saying it would devalue their property, cause traffic congestion, and obstruct vistas. Organizations such as the LDS Church and Auerbach's Department Store voiced support for the museum and made donations to the building fund, but the neighbors took the DUP to court. The case made it to Utah's Supreme Court, where justices debated whether it was fair for state funds to support a nonprofit, and questioned whether the DUP were unfairly promoting the Mormon faith in their storytelling. Because museums are exempt from city zoning laws, the DUP argued their right to build just west of the Capitol. The court eventually ruled in their favor, saying the DUP were contributing to a public good by preserving the history of the state's early white settlers. The Pioneer Memorial Museum, despite all opposition, became Utah's de facto state museum for years to come. Find sources in past episodes of the Beehive Archive at utahhumanities.org. For the Beehive Archive, a production of Utah Humanities, I'm Megan Weiss.